This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start at the top of the front page with the headline, Downtown Plan Top Cities 2014 Agenda. This article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with a Dateline of Raleigh. What will the next 10 years look like for downtown Raleigh? That's the pressing question that a newly commissioned downtown plan will set out to answer when an international design firm hired earlier this week is expected to complete its study later this year. The Raleigh City Council on January 7 selected Sasaki Associates Incorporated, a Boston-area international design firm, to prepare the new downtown plan for $343,500. Sasaki and its team will in turn be working with the 22-member Downtown Plan Advisory Committee, led by co-chairs Ed Frisch, the CEO and president of Raleigh-based Highwoods Properties, and former city council member Ann S. Franklin. The process should take about 9 months to complete, says Mitchell Silver, the chief planning and development officer for the city. It's a pretty ambitious time frame, he says, but we have a list of things we want to pursue. Jim Belt, co-founder and president of the citizen group Downtown Living Advocates, says he thinks the city leaders and downtown residents and businesses are already pulling in the same direction. It's more about prioritizing what needs to get done first, he says. Near the top of Belt's list, and Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarland's list is transit, how to better move people into, out of, and around downtown. The transit issue for me is almost silly. We need to make long-term decisions now, Belt says. If you think it's 10 years away, what happens when you put another million people into the city? Belt says downtown Raleigh could also improve its walkability. There's too many missing teeth or dead zones that discourage important pedestrian activity, he says. I would like to see the downtown vision include a plan to fill the gaps by understanding and improving those factors that make parcels of land or empty buildings attractive to developers. Ross Massey, leader of the Raleigh Office for Charlotte-based Land Design, says that while he's disappointed that his firm came in third among the 11 consulting firms that bid on the Downtown Plan Consulting Project, he's glad the city is moving forward with the process. This is part of the city prioritizing what we are going to be investing in major capital improvement projects, which will be a springboard for private investment, he says. The last time Raleigh city leaders adopted a revitalization plan for downtown Raleigh, the Livable Streets Plan in 2003, it led to the opening of Fayetteville Street Mall to traffic again and the construction of the $222 million Raleigh Convention Center. It also helped spur more than $2 billion in other public and private investment projects that have been completed, planned, or are under construction in the downtown district since that time, downtown advocates say. The city's first choice for the downtown plan assignment had been a team led by Aaron Krantz, Eckstut, and Kuhn, architects of New York, but Silver says his staff later decided to go with the second choice team led by Sasaki, which has helped plan and design projects all around the world, including the Olympic Green for the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Working with Sasaki on the Raleigh downtown plan will be the Kling Stubbins design firm, which has an office in Raleigh, the Kimley Horn engineering firm that's based in Cary, and the HRNA advisory firm of New York. Of the nearly $350,000 fee approved for Sasaki, 70% of it is being paid with $250,000 raised through private donations to Downtown Raleigh Alliance, which granted the money to the city in August to help pay for the plan. The balance will be paid through the city's planning and public works department's budgets, Silver says. Sasaki is charged with establishing short, mid, and long-term plans for potential redevelopment, public realm, infrastructure, and connectivity improvements throughout the greater downtown area, not just the Fayetteville Street corridor that had been the focus of the Livable Streets Plan, Silver says. He also noted that all of the finalist consultant groups had local firms that were teaming with to bid on the project. All of the teams typically, if they are not the prime, have subcontractors with local knowledge, Silver says. We always take that into consideration when we make our recommendation to council. And next on the front page is the cover story. The cover story has the headline, Mental Health Block North Carolina's new MCO system leaves providers' patients out in the cold. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a dateline of Raleigh. There is an ominous cloud over North Carolina's mental health care system that many fear is limiting access to care and treatment by those who need it the most. As a means of saving costs, about a year ago, North Carolina implemented a novel system of paying for the $2.3 billion in annual mental health care of the state's poorest citizens through an ever-shrinking number of managed care organizations, MCOs, that have little oversight or accountability. While state leaders claim the new arrangement will save taxpayers money, any resulting reduction in care would mean overcrowded emergency rooms, higher incarceration rates, and more homelessness. As some say, that's a high price to pay for efficiency. Crystal Goldson, who has been building her practice for 5 years in Johnston County, is doing everything she can to ensure her patients who suffer from a mental or behavioral health illness get the treatment they need, but she faces an uphill battle, and she's not alone. Along with dozens of other mental health providers, she has turned to the courts just so they can keep their existing contracts to see Medicaid patients. That's because under the state's new payment system, MCOs have the unbridled authority to terminate providers in an attempt to keep costs down with little accountability for the process. Patients aren't going to know where to go to access services, Goldston says. Those patients are going to suffer. How Goldston and other providers got here is a combination of multiple factors: fraud and abuse by bad actors in years past, a politicized healthcare system, and a stigmatized population which has few advocates and a weak voice. Shifting control to MCOs. In the past, some mental health providers in North Carolina would fraudulently charge Medicaid for services barely provided or not provided at all. In a legitimate effort to cut down on this fraud, legislators in the early 2000s started working on new laws to weed out the bad actors. As lawmakers changed, however, so did their policies, and the result was a lack of continuity for providers and their patients. At the same time, the state has in recent years cut many administrative positions within the department that oversees Medicaid, leaving the program understaffed, with existing staff underpaid compared to the private sector. Dr. Marvin Swartz, Division Head of Social and Community Psychiatry at Duke Health, says these factors have mixed together to form a troublesome stew. You're trying to control costs, but also trying to maintain access, he says. How to achieve that balance is a hard thing to know. MCOs register as not-for-profit organizations and receive fixed amounts of money from the state called their capitation. Unlike physical health care providers, when Medicaid patients receive mental health services, their providers bill these MCOs instead of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. If an MCO doesn't spend up its capitation level, it keeps the remainder. And therein lies the problem, say provider advocates. While the theory is that a managing entity closer to providers and patients is better equipped to evaluate and encourage the right care at the right time, advocates fear the result is to reduce available care. It's logical that MCOs should have some control over their provider networks. MCOs can promote consolidation among providers to reduce administrative costs, a good first step in any attempt to reduce costs. But consolidation also reduces competition and can therefore jeopardize quality. Access to care is key to people getting well, staying well, getting preventative care, and being able to live stably in the community. That is the crux of the whole issue, says Robin Huffman, Executive Director of the North Carolina Psychiatric Association. Lack of oversight. Ideally, the state, through the Division of Medical Assistance, would police MCOs to make sure they are reimbursing the proper providers and providing incentives for good care. But providers say these MCOs are improperly denying claims and reducing provider networks to such a degree that those on Medicaid who need mental health services no longer have access to care. Goldston, who operates Essential Supportive Services in Johnston County, says her practice was abruptly notified that it would not have its contract renewed. Clients were notified that their services were being interrupted prior to their therapeutic provider having the opportunity to properly communicate transition planning, she says, adding that hers is just one example. Nicole Emanuel, an attorney with Williams Mullen in Raleigh, has worked with more than 50 providers with similar stories. I have seen the MCOs terminate a provider without cause and for unjustified reasons, she says. The providers have no recourse. MCOs have denied this. The myth that we are trying to eliminate every provider in our network is not an accurate statement, says Rob Robinson, Chief Operating Officer for Alliance Behavioral Healthcare, the MCO that covers Wake, Durham, Johnston, and Cumberland counties. But determining whether or not the MCOs are eliminating only the bad actors is nearly impossible to tell. The state doesn't require MCOs to provide documentation about why a provider was eliminated, nor does it track how many providers each MCO has added or eliminated over any given time period. When asked about provider networks, Dave Richard, director of the North Carolina Division of Mental Health, said, "I think we are monitoring that very closely." But when pressed about numbers, he acknowledged the state doesn't require MCOs to report them. He says that state leaders are in constant conversation with the MCOs and have a feel for the size and scope of provider networks that way. Still, decreasing networks is necessary to save money, he says. We know there is probably too large a provider network, he says. Wake Brook fills a gap. There are some steps being taken to treat patients with mental health issues that nearly everyone agrees are positive, such as at UNC Wake Brook. This facility provides various levels of care, including inpatient and detox, that many in Wake County have said are sorely lacking. Hospitals may send patients to this facility and relieve overcrowding at area emergency departments. The Mental and Behavioral Health Hospital is operated by UNC Healthcare per an agreement between UNC and WakeMed Health and Hospitals, wherein UNC Healthcare CEO Dr. Bill Roper agreed to invest $40 million in mental health in Wake County. Paula Bird, Wake Brook administrator, says she's heard of no problems with MCO reimbursement, although billing has lagged. What's next? As part of the state's effort to improve the system, Richard says many of the MCOs will merge, and that has already began to happen. The state began with 41 local management entities that merged to 12 MCOs that have already merged down to 10. And Richard has a plan to bring that down to 4 in the next year or so. Similar to a private insurer, an MCO can better manage a population by spreading risk. Currently, Alliance covers 185,000 people. Richard says he thinks each MCO would need to cover roughly 350,000 in order to maximize efficiency. We think that is the right number, Richard says. We think that number works. Swartz says the state should pick a plan and actually stick to it. That's tough, given the political environment. This has become such a political football that it's undermining the ability to set steady policy directions, Swartz says. Swartz sees even darker clouds in the future, though, as the Affordable Care Act grows increasingly politicized. Unless and until North Carolina can effectively decouple Medicaid from political wins, particularly the mental health portion, he fears not much will improve. And there are two side articles to this cover story. The first one is headlined, "This Has Worked, CCNC." Because the state divides Medicaid into mental health and physical health and pays for those services in very different ways, there are inherent incentive conflicts. Consider a person who enters an emergency room with liver failure. That is, at the surface, a physical health problem. But because that liver failure might be due to an alcohol addiction, there are potential mental health factors as well. The MCOs would have an incentive to place that patient completely under a physical health state so it would not have to reimburse the hospital, while the state would want that patient classified as a mental health patient so the MCOs would have to pick up the bill. Robinson of Alliance acknowledges the potential conflict, but that Alliance has only the best interests of patients at heart and works to find the best solution for every situation. When a patient is admitted to an emergency room for complex reasons, he says that patient is flagged, and Alliance works with organizations like Community Care of North. CCNC has worked with Medicaid on the physical health side to better manage patients. Although it has similarities to an MCO, it does not operate in a capitated model, so the incentive structure is different. A financial audit estimated that CCNC saved the state more than $1 billion in the four-year period from 2007 through 2010 by managing the Medicaid population. Richard, the mental health director, also acknowledges the inherent incentive conflict and cites that as a reason for Medicaid reform, which the state is pushing both generally and in mental health specifically. How you align financial incentives are certainly important, he says, but that the state can't just wave a magic wand and have everything work out perfectly, especially in a system that has grown siloed over time. We want to get a system that properly incentivizes everything, he says. Indeed, Richard has met with organizations connected in nearly any way to mental health in order to figure out how best to form a system that takes care of each patient's needs while saving taxpayers money, a difficult problem to say the least. How the state deals with mental and behavioral health patients, particularly those covered by Medicaid, has enormous consequences to state taxpayers, who through the Medicaid program spend roughly $2.5 billion annually for patients with mental illnesses. And the other related article is headlined, Is This Working? MCOs. In the 1990s, Medicaid paid for mental health care through the fee-for-service model. Under this model, Medicaid essentially just reimburses everything a provider bills. Healthcare experts nearly unanimously agree that there were bad actors who took advantage of that system, which led to there being too many mental health care providers. In a perfectly run system, there would be exactly the right number of providers to bring needed health care to patients, but not too many who then file improper charges or provide duplicative care. The responsibility of downsizing provider networks was left up to the MCOs as a tool so they can efficiently spend money. Robinson of Alliance said that was a point the MCOs were firm on. If the state was going to capitate their revenue, they needed that tool to eliminate providers out of the network. They have said to us, run this like a business, Robinson says, repeating that the MCOs carry the financial risk under the capitation system, not the state. Richard, the state's mental health director, says he wants to keep the right providers. We want to make sure that we don't downsize too quickly, he says. However, the state has very little policing authority. If an MCO cuts out a provider, that provider may file an appeal, but it goes back to the MCO, not to the state. The only recourse a provider has outside the MCO is through the courts, an area some have turned to, some with success. Federal regulators apparently also find flaws with the model that North Carolina has implemented. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, notified the state's acting Medicaid director that it essentially deems in the relationship between the MCOs and the state to be improper. In a response to CMS, acting director Sandra Terrell responded that the state was surprised to receive the letter from CMS and that it could put together documentation to prove that the relationship is proper. That argument had not been officially made to CMS by publication. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings. It starts off with the headline, Whitehurst to inspire Campbell grads. Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst has been tapped to deliver the commencement address at Campbell University's Norman A. Wiggins School of Law's May graduation. Whitehurst calls the invitation an honor. I look forward to saluting these graduates on this prestigious accomplishment and sharing a few experiences that I hope will inspire them as they begin their legal careers, he says. Campbell Law Dean J. Richard Leonard says Whitehurst was picked for his business acumen and leadership abilities. Whitehurst joined open-source software giant Red Hat in 2008, leading it through the expansion that led to downtown Raleigh's own Red Hat Tower, as well as the $1 billion revenue milestone in 2012. The ties that bind may not extend to VC. Jim Hundley, co-founder of Wilmington circulation device startup Go2, has friends in the right places. Specifically, Hundley told Biz, he's the brother-in-law of Southern Capital Ventures partner David Jones. But that's not going to help him complete his $1 million fundraiser for his device, Good Blood Flow. It's too small for venture capital, he says. That's why he's turned to grants and other opportunities, so far raising $500,000, including financing from the Kauffman Foundation. His goal is to have his device, which looks like a foot massager but isn't, in a big box store in 2014. Raleigh Olympian dives into new waters. Charlie Huchin, that's spelled H-O-U-C-H-I-N, a Raleigh native who won a gold medal as a member of the winning United States team in the 4x200-meter freestyle relay at the 2012 Summer Olympics in London, has partnered with Triangle entrepreneur Michael Curran to found a technology company called Hydrosphere, in Kerry. It's spelled H-Y-D-R-O-X-P-H-E-R-E. Under Huchin's direction, Hydrosphere has developed a smartphone app called Meet Central, which is designed to help make running summer swim meets faster and easier. Meet Central caters to summer swim leagues and clubs by helping starters, timers, judges, and scorekeepers run meets, time and judge heats, and record times automatically. The app aims to help summer swim meets run more efficiently with fewer volunteers. 30 Under 30 winner hails from Raleigh. Biz caught up with the newly famous Wilson Owens this week, the co-founder of Royalty Exchange, a Raleigh startup that auctions off royalties for high-ticket items such as music catalogs, just claimed a spot on Forbes' 30 Under 30 in Music list. And it was a complete surprise, sort of. I found out this morning, he says, the day of the announcement. But he had to get suspicious when Forbes contacted him a few months ago to do an interview. I knew it might happen, and I knew the list was coming out today, he says. His first phone call? His girlfriend. Angus Barn Tree in Upside Down Wonder. Van Uhr, owner of the fabled Angus Barn restaurant in Raleigh, never stops thinking of efficiencies. In this instance, it was about space. Biz was at Angus Barn during the holidays and noticed that the restaurant's Christmas tree was hanging from the ceiling upside down, decorated to the hilt. The tree ran from the two-story ceiling to the floor. Have not seen that before at the restaurant, and curious, Biz asked Uhr the reason. She told us it was twofold. First, the width of such a large tree often took much of the floor near the reception area. By inverting it, the widest part of the tree resided near the ceiling. And second, as she correctly stated, in the 12th century, Central Europeans hung trees upside down to conserve floor space. Biz also read that the inverted tree represented the Holy Trinity. Regardless, it looked wonderful, as evidenced by the number of people at the restaurant admiring it. Contributing to Biz were staffers Jesse Burkhart and Lauren Onsorge. And turning to our full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal, we have a short article headlined, Governor McCrory, Four Biggest Challenges North Carolina Faces in 2014. And this is written by Dawn Curry with a Dateline of Raleigh. This year, North Carolina will see more net job growth than in the last 5 years, says Governor Pat McCrory, who spoke Monday at the North Carolina Bankers Association's 12th Annual Economic Outlook Forum held at the Sheridan Imperial in Durham. McCrory says he made several tough decisions last year that will help the state going forward. Those include not extending unemployment benefits, not expanding Medicaid, pushing for tax reform to make the state more attractive for business, initiating transportation reform to encourage more funding for infrastructure, and reforming the Commerce Department. McCrory says the state's biggest challenges in 2014 will be Medicaid, education, labor skills, and energy. We have to do better in tech, science, and math, he says. North Carolina has to get involved in energy. We've been on the sidelines for 10 years. McCrory also says he believes our state's oldest industry, agriculture, will be what ultimately brings North Carolina out of the recession. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we have the page for Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. And her first section is in a block called On the Web. The headline, North Carolina Treasurer Looking for Raleigh Office Space. North Carolina State Treasurer Janet Cowell's office wants to consolidate its 400 employees scattered among five office buildings in the Raleigh area into one, and that could result in a big windfall for one lucky landlord. Her department has issued a request for proposals for up to 96,641 square feet in the Raleigh area with a 10-year lease and renewal options. The deadline is January 17. The department is considering space options and the cost-benefit of relocating to a common building, says State Treasurer spokesman Shore Johnson. Currently, the State Treasurer's office is based in the state-owned Albemarle Building at the corner of Salisbury Street and Lane Street, but it shares the 11-story building that was built in 1970 with the Department of Health and Human Services, Division of Veterans Affairs, and other agencies. The treasurer's office also leases space for staff in three other buildings in Raleigh. And in a section called By the Numbers, 96,641, the number of square feet of office space that the Department of State Treasurer would need for a consolidation of Raleigh offices. 400, the number of employees in the office of the State Treasurer, Janet Cowell, who would work in the new office space. And the next article on reporter Amanda Hoyle's page is headlined, Done Deal, General Parts Sale to Advance. The anticipated $2 billion sale of Raleigh-based auto parts retailer General Parts International Incorporated was made official last week, according to an announcement from GPI's new owner, Advance Auto Parts Incorporated. The transaction boosts Roanoke, Virginia-based Advance Auto into the number one position as the largest automotive aftermarket parts provider in North America, bypassing former market leader, Memphis-based AutoZone. The Advance Auto acquisition of GPI creates a company with combined annual sales of $9.3 billion, 5,264 company-owned stores, and more than 70,000 employees. AutoZone has 5,210 stores, 42,000 employees, and $9.25 billion in annual revenue, according to Yahoo Finance. The Advance Auto announcement, however, did not detail the impact the deal would have on General Parts' headquarters operations in Raleigh, where it employs about 500 people. General Parts owned 1,246 company stores that operated under the CarQuest brand. The combined company will continue to provide services to the 1,418 independent CarQuest store locations in the U.S. and Canada. Advance will also add Worldpac, GPI's import company, with 105 facilities across the U.S. and Canada to its operation. The company previously stated that GPI President and CEO Temple Sloan III would continue as president of General Parts and was expected to join the Advance Auto Parts Board of Directors. GPI founder and chairman Temple Sloan Jr., who we recently profiled as a Triangle Titan, and a pioneer in the Triangle business community, will remain as an advisor. Is Cherokee plugging into China's energy market? Executives at Cherokee Investment Partners in Raleigh have so far been quiet about what they are doing with the new entity that raised $11.6 million last fall called Industrial Heat LLC. But there's at least one theory circulating among the energy production market that Industrial Heat is one of the backers behind a new energy catalyzer device being developed by inventor Andrea Rossi. Rossi, in turn, has been pitching the thermal heat energy technology to Chinese officials with help from Cherokee, according to the blog site ECAT World. Cherokee CEO Tom Darden says that due to strict confidentiality requirements, he can't address any of the specific technologies that Industrial Heat is supporting. But the company has investigated or supported several, he says. I am sure it will be a while before there are any results. Darden says none of the entities referenced in the ECAT World blogs have invested in Industrial Heat, nor does any Industrial Heat have any Chinese investors, he says. When Industrial Heat reported to the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission in August that it had raised $11.6 million of a proposed $20 million round of financing. It noted that 14 investors had provided funding so far. Darden and Cherokee senior analyst J.T. Vaughn were listed as managers of the fund. Vaughn also spearheads the Cherokee McDonough Challenge that, through Cherokee and its advisory group, helps support and fund startup environmental companies. Darden says that on a recent trip to China, industrial heat was one of the topics he discussed with Chinese officials. But my main focus was to encourage them to bring new environmental technologies to China from some of the challenge companies. And in a section headlined Retailing and Restaurants, there's the headline, Durham Center Breaks Ground, Raleigh Adds More Dumplings. Durham city leaders gathered on January 6 to celebrate a milestone for the Southwest Central Durham neighborhood with a groundbreaking ceremony for the $13 million Kent Corner building project. Kent Corner is a 46,800-square-foot office and retail building project by Self Help, the nonprofit lender, real estate developer, and credit union group in Durham. Self Help has been working with the city and neighborhood activists for several months. Finalizing plans for the former city-owned parking lot property at 111 West Chapel Hill Street. Kent Corner will be anchored by new offices for the Center for Child and Family Health, which will occupy most of the 33,000-square-foot office building that will face Kent Street. A new dumpling and noodle shop has signed a lease for a Raleigh restaurant space near the Hillsborough Street roundabout at Pullen Road. The Marco and Luca Dumpling Store plans to open by March, says Stacy Bithy, with the trademark Morris commercial real estate firm in Chapel Hill, who represented the restaurant owners in the lease negotiations. The Marco and Luca Dumpling Store will be opened in a 2,065-square-foot space at 2010 Hillsborough Street. And we have two articles on the reporter page for Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare, higher education, and nonprofits. The first is headlined Online Course Stats. At Duke University, only about 3% of those who enrolled in a massive open online course, MOOC, actually completed it, while the university had 876,354 enrollments in MOOCs, an online learning method for which students don't receive credit. Only 29,551 finished them. Duke leaders acknowledge that figure may seem low given such a high number of initial enrollments, but echoed many in academia. People don't enroll in these MOOCs to complete their work, but to advance general education or knowledge. And under a section headlined Higher Education Costs, the headline, UNC System Pushes for Tuition Freeze. University leaders will soon decide whether or not to make good on President Tom Ross's recommendation to freeze tuition for all undergraduate resident students next year. In August, Ross proposed no tuition increases for students from North Carolina and has been vocal on his steadfastness on that recommendation since. Boards of trustees from the 16 campuses throughout the state agreed, and now it's up to the Board of Governors, which oversees the entire University of North Carolina system, to make its final call. Though Ross proposed no tuition increase, there are some campuses who have proposed various fee increases, including North Carolina State University, which proposed fee increases of 4% to $2,095. UNC Chapel Hill's general fees would increase less than 1% to $1,711. If the BOG enacts what Ross proposed, non-residents would see a significant tuition bump, including a 12% increase at UNC Chapel Hill and a 6% increase at North Carolina Central University. NC State would not increase tuition for out-of-state students. Since November of 2010, the Board of Governors has been acting under the current four-year plan, which includes the following stipulations. Tuition and general fee increases shall not exceed 6.5%, fees for debt service excluded. If recurring state operating appropriations increase by more than 6%, the tuition ceiling for the next academic year is reduced by 1% for each percentage above 6%. Combined tuition and fee rates for resident undergraduate students must be in the bottom quartile of an institution's public peers. Of course, every time tuition is discussed, the North Carolina Constitution is brought up. Article 9, Section 9 of the Constitution reads, "The General Assembly shall provide that the benefits of the University of North Carolina and other public institutions of higher education, as far as practicable, be extended to the people of the state free of expense." Of course, coming to a conclusion about what is practicable is always up for debate, which tends to muddy the waters when discussing tuition. And now we have the reporter page for Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. And her first section is titled, "They Said It." While 2013 was a good year for Triangle Entrepreneurship, 2014 could be an even better year, according to local entrepreneurs such as AdZerk's James Avery, Organic Transit's Rob Cotter, and Ground Floor's Brian Daly. But I wanted specifics, so I asked the area entrepreneurs, what are your entrepreneurial New Year's resolutions for 2014? And this is from Barley Labs founders Scott Beaudry and Teresa Chu. Teresa Chu's, "Our resolution is to keep the promises we made to our customers and supporters over this past year. We want to improve our current product line and create new ones, support other small businesses, and broaden our support of rescue organizations in the area and across the country." And the next is from Matt Williamson, who is the founder of Windsor Circle, a marketing firm that has been raising cash in 2013. "I resolve to help retailers leverage big data to respectfully offer the right things to the right people at the right time in a way that blows away customer expectations and generates fanatical customer loyalty for my clients. I resolve to build the world's best retention automation platform." And finally, from Brian Batten, founder of Intitl, a Wilmington-based startup that offers what could be the Netflix of ebooks. "Our resolution is that we never become complacent, and continue to hustle and push the envelope on strategy, technology, and service to better our members and stakeholders and stay ahead of the competition." And in another section titled Resolutions 2014, the headline, "Five Resolutions, Five Startups to Help." Whatever your New Year's resolutions, chances are there's a startup for that. Here are five common resolutions and the companies here in the Triangle that can help you fulfill them. Resolution, quit smoking. Chapel Hill-based e-nicotine technology may have your solution. The startup, which nabbed a $4 million equity boost in September, is developing what it calls a clean nicotine technology, an aerosol device that can deliver nicotine into the deep lung for rapid absorption. Resolution, lose weight. Derm-based FitSistence is a tool to connect you to your personal trainer. Personal trainers can track your progress and your compliance. That way they know if you really did all those crunches this morning. Resolution, eat healthier. Derm-based INR Food helps add context to what you're eating. The goal of the app is to help you understand what's in your food. Theoretically, if you know what you're eating, you'll make better choices. Resolution, spend more time playing with your kids. Durham-based Squord, spelled S-Q-O-R-D, is a social platform that lets kids track their own fitness activities and compete with their friends. Kids wear a special activity tracker and they play away. While Squord keeps track of their physical activity, it's marketed as an easy, fun way to encourage fitness and playtime outside. Resolution, class up your wardrobe. Raleigh-based Clique Publique has a prescription for that, with a new line of handbags from designer and North Carolina State University alum, Kristen Shambra Stevens. And don't forget the Raleigh Workshop, formerly known as Raleigh Denim, which isn't just jeans anymore. And in a final section titled Deal Makers, the headline, Medtronic snags Papas-backed TYRX for $160 million. Minneapolis pharma Medtronic has acquired Tyrex, TYRX, meaning a big exit for Durham investment firm Papas Ventures. Tyrex, a New Jersey-based developer of implantable drugs and medical devices, was acquired in an all-cash deal that includes an initial payment of $160 million, plus the potential for earn-out and performance-based milestone payments. And Papas venture partner Ford Worthy hinted that we should keep our eye on Tyrex last month, pointing to it as a portfolio standout. Tyrex's product, an antibiotic-eluting mesh envelope used with pacemakers and other implanted cardiac devices, directly reduces the risk, adding that an important ongoing trend in life science investing is focusing on products that reduce overall healthcare spending. Papas Ventures is just one of Tyrex's backers. Earlier this year, the company nabbed the support of Long Beach, California-based Memorial Care Innovation Fund. Art Papas, founder of Papas Ventures, was also on the Tyrex board. The company raised $2 million in May, according to a securities filing. Papas investments are across the spectrum of life science companies, from seed and startup to later stage financing deals. Its portfolio includes firms scattered across North America, including Chapel Hill nanotech startup Liquidia Technologies. Papas also backed one of the Triangle's IPO successes of 2013, Chimerix. And our final reporter page is that of Dawn Curry. Curry covers money and small business. And the first, a section titled On the Web with the headline, News Flash, That Honey Bun is Full of Calories. As part of the Affordable Care Act, the FDA will draw up guidelines in the first part of this year for companies with more than 20 vending machines, which will have to post calorie counts for the items being sold. Jeff Morgan, owner of Garner-based Tops Vending Services, it has nearly 100 vending machines throughout the Triangle, says the government has already begun requiring food packaging companies to print the calorie count on the front of the product. The ACA mandates that color-coded tabs called pushers be added to vending machines so customers know how healthy the products are. Morgan, who's been in the vending business for 25 years, says he's been promoting healthy products and supplying healthy options such as veggie chips where customers want them. He says the cost of installing the pushers on his machines will be about $200. And another article has the headline, Frequent Flyer Miles May Be Jettisoned. Welcome to 2014, a year that could be a game changer for business travelers, says one group. Boyd Group International, an aviation forecasting company based in Colorado, says 2014 could spell the end of commercial airlines' frequent flyer programs. In what is deemed a disruptive reality by Boyd Group in its aviation forecast for 2014, changes to airline frequent flyer programs will be the next set of de facto ancillary revenues. First, the recently announced increases in miles needed for free travel at some airlines is just the start. Second, the requirements for fare spend will increase. And third, co-pays will become a lot more common. Basically, you may need to use up more frequent flyer miles than before to get travel perks. But Southwest Airlines, the most popular airline leaving Raleigh-Durham International Airport, has no such plans. Rapid Rewards is one of the cornerstones of our consumer championing products, offering our customers any seat on any flight as a potential award seat with their banked points, said Brad Hawkins with Southwest. We have no plans to change the program, which continues to top many rankings. Meanwhile, the Boyd Group says in 2014, airlines are not adding meaningful capacity. The group says airlines will add capacity and new markets only, where it will improve the cost-revenue relationship. Passenger volume isn't the planning imperative, neither are the needs of a given community. Southwest seems to be on board with this notion as well. Hawkins says, Southwest has plans to keep capacity flat as we continue to take new aircraft deliveries and wrap the final chapter of the integration of AirTran Airways and its international portfolio of destinations to be served by Southwest Airlines. And the final section on this page is titled By the Numbers, and it's headlined Cleanup on Route 1. North Carolina's new Advanced Technology Public Education campaign will feature billboards with reminders about clean and green driving habits. $1 saved per gallon by using natural gas or propane. 25 cents per gallon, that's how much extra you'll pay for every 5 miles per hour over 50 miles per hour you drive. Save 66%. You'll save 66% using an electric vehicle. They cost two-thirds less to drive. The family budget. An average family will spend more on transportation than on food. And transit pays. The average U.S. transit rider could save up to $10,000 a year or a million pennies. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the CEO Corner section that focuses on La Farm Bakery. And the headline, There's Something in the Oven. And this article is written by Dawn Curry with a Dateline of Cary. Early morning hours are a bustle at La Farm Bakery in Cary, where the bakers begin preparing for the day around midnight. Owner and master baker Lionel Vadinette shares the business with his wife, Missy. What you see is her, what you smell is me, says Lionel in a thick French accent. His bread is baked fresh each day, but the recipes and techniques were passed down to him from a long line of master bakers through the guild that Missy claims dates back to Solomon's temples. Missy, with a background in marketing and consulting, handles the business side. Lionel brags that she knows every detail of the shop, including where products should be placed to attract the right customers. Rise of a Master. At age 16, Lionel began an apprenticeship in France's Artisans Guild, Les Compagnons du Devoir, and he earned the title of Master Baker 7 years later. Thus began what he characterizes as a lifelong journey of demystifying and teaching the ancient art of bread baking. As a consultant to bakeries and stores, he traveled across Europe, the Middle East, Central and South America, Canada, and the United States. In 1995, he founded the San Francisco Baking Institute. In 1999, Vadinette was on the team that took home America's first gold medal at the International Olympic-style baking competition, La Coupe du Monde de la Boulangerie. He's been featured on The Rachel Ray Show and serves on the advisory board for Wake Technical Community College's culinary program. Settling into business. Now Vadinette produces 15 different breads and 20 seasonal loaves throughout the year using the same oven he bought when the Vadinettes opened their Cary business in 1998. We got two other bakers and flew to Colorado to move it, he says. We bought it used for $10,000. It weighed 5 tons and we had to take it apart to move it. It took 2 weeks to rebuild it and weeks to clean it. We didn't know what we were getting ourselves into, but when you want to start a business, you know, you do whatever $100,000 German Miwi, spelled M-I-W-E oven, which Vadinette says is a Rolls-Royce. Company milestones. Upgrades like the oven are significant milestones for the Vadinettes, who grew their business together after they became romantically involved. Missy jokes that she fell in love with his ciabatta. She thought the move was risky, as most businesses aren't successful and neither are many romantic relationships, but they pooled their financial resources, $100,000 each, to start the business. The bakery was a bird shop full of cages. The cafe, where today's customers can sit and have coffee or a sandwich, didn't come until much later, in 2009. It had been a dry cleaning shop. Even with the cafe, the Vadinettes are firm that the business is first and foremost a bakery. In addition to breads, the bakery offers baked goods, desserts, catering, gift baskets, and canned goods. Choosing where to start their business was as important to their product as the ingredients themselves. The Cary community, with its diverse population and mix of global cultures, seemed to ensure a ready market for the bakery goods. The right formula. La Farm's breads need water, salt, yeast, and flour, but not just any flour. North Carolina is known for soft wheat used in biscuits and animal feed, explains Lionel. Bakers need a hard wheat, a winter wheat. What he sought was hidden in the sandhills. Billy Carter, owner of Carter Farms in the Moore County town of Eagle Springs, supplies the wheat for Lionel's European-style breads. It is processed through Carolina Grounds Mill in Asheville. The mountain town also hosts the annual Asheville Bread Festival, which the Vadnets frequent to make local connections. Lionel said the more local ingredients you use, the healthier your product is. We've always known this, he says. That's why local honey is best. It helps with allergies. The goal is to use local ingredients, but currently, the bakery's white flour comes from the Midwest. The cafe's coffee comes from Durham's Counterculture Coffee. Food tax setbacks. In 2005, the bakery was slapped with a notice from the North Carolina Department of Revenue for $150,000 in back taxes, and revenue officials told the Vadnets they should have been charging 7.75% in sales tax for prepared foods instead of just the 2% sales tax. The revenue department interpreted the tax code as it applied to breads as requiring a 2% sales tax, but the department's auditing division interpreted breads as prepared foods, meaning two or more edible ingredients were combined to create the product, and those require a 7.75% prepared foods tax to be collected. Our argument is bread ingredients are not edible. You can't eat flour, yeast, salt, therefore we are not combining edible ingredients, and bread should have a 2% sales tax. For 3 years, La Farm Bakery's owners put plans to expand the bakery on hold and lobbied lawmakers to change the tax code. Once the law was changed, the bakery owners regained their footing and expanded their business from 20 employees to 70 in 5 years. From baker to author. While some bakers have traveled to Cary from as far as Peru to take one of Lionel's cooking classes, they needn't traverse the world to gain his knowledge. In November, Lionel published a Passion for Bread to pass on his artisanal knowledge. And in the People on the Move section, the People Spotlight is on Zachary Donahue, Chief Audit Executive and Executive Director of Internal Audit at WakeMed Health and Hospitals. Armed with nearly 20 years of accounting experience, Zachary Donahue has now parlayed that knowledge into a new role as Chief Audit Executive and Executive Director of Internal Audit at WakeMed Health and Hospitals. Donahue's past professional experience includes public accounting work and a brief stint at the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. Donahue's current post is a new one at WakeMed. In this position, Donahue is charged with leadership, director, and oversight of the internal audit function at WakeMed. As the system's key internal controls advisor and monitor, as he calls it, Donahue will work closely with the senior management team in conducting ongoing risk assessments, monitoring of regulatory changes, and monitoring of information system vulnerabilities that could impact the system's internal control environment and related operating policies and procedures. WakeMed has gone through a few changes in recent months. The most significant came in September 2013 when its former CEO, Bill Atkinson, announced he would resign. The move came at the switchover of the hospital's fiscal year, which runs from October to September, just as WakeMed announced its first operating loss in years and projected a 2013 to 2014 year that wasn't much rosier. On October 24, WakeMed announced Rear Admiral Donald Ginzig as interim president and CEO. WakeMed's team comprises 8,500 employees, 1,500 volunteers, more than 1,200 affiliated physicians, and 240 physicians employed by WakeMed physician practices. Background. Donahue was born in Anderson, Indiana. He attended Indiana University, where he received and rose through the ranks, becoming senior accountant, manager, and later senior manager. He relocated to the Triangle with Clifton Gunderson in 2004 to open its Raleigh office. Later, he joined Chan LLC as an internal audit manager for a large hospital system. After about 3 years as a senior technical manager with the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants in Durham, Donahue then went back into public accounting, where he opened and ran the Raleigh office for Myers and Stauffer until accepting his current position with Wake Med. He has been at the hospital system for about a month. Goal: I hope to establish a first-class internal audit team leading to increased internal controls and reduced risk to the organization, Donahue says. What's your biggest worry? Failure, Donahue says. Personal: Donahue and his wife Andrea have 2 children, Sean and Lauren. Last book read: Change the Culture, Change the Game by Roger Connors and Tom Smith. And with our remaining time, we'll read as much as we can from the Viewpoint page, the editor's notebook, headlined Waiting on Answers. We may soon get an unprecedented look into the workings of the Office of the State Treasurer, caretakers of the state's $83 billion pension fund for some 875 North Carolinians. For people who have not been following the issue, a law firm hired by North Carolina Department of Justice presented a report in December to current State Treasurer Janet Cowell after examining the agency's relationships between investment managers and their brokers in the past. That prompted Cowell to issue a series of new rules and governance standards that would prevent brokers from providing substantial gifts to employees. And we're going to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and a visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.
Online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.